content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spergotta for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Samantha Vicente is titled, Meet the First Latina to Become President of the UN General Assembly. If you've ever wondered what it'd feel like to be a minor character in a spy thriller, I recommend paying the President of the United Nations General Assembly a visit. Upon stepping out of a cab in front of the UN's imposing flag-festooned New York headquarters, an aide whisks visitors through a series of security checkpoints that begin with a TSA-comparable screening before rapidly escalating to flashing a cool temporary badge at various uniformed guards as yet another door opens. This is how I met Maria Fernanda Espinosa, the 73rd President of the UN General Assembly. I have to say it proudly, I am the first female Latin American president in UN history, Espinosa tells OprahMag.com. The seasoned diplomat and politician is also the fourth woman ever elected to the highest position in the organization, garnering 128 votes from 193 member states in 2018. We met in Her Excellency's office for our chat, where earth-toned mid-century modern furniture complements wood-paneled walls, and the windows offer a soothing, almost cruise ship-like view of the East River. Two tributes to Espinosa's home country of Ecuador sit on the glass coffee table, a brilliant blue rose and a bowl full of Pocari mini chocolate bars with flavors like Cusco pink salt and nibs. Like Espinosa herself, the room somehow felt both warm and commanding. As President of the UN General Assembly from September 2018 to September 2019, Espinosa's work took her around the globe, from closed-door meetings with heads of state to Jordan's Zaatari camp for Syrian refugees. She's quick to point out that the organization is more than just a talk shop. The United Nations feeds 90 million people a year and assists on the ground following natural disasters, in addition to setting high-level policy that impacts the entire world. No country alone can address these issues because they are transboundary issues by nature, Espinosa explains. My role as president is making sure we agree on the fundamentals. Prior to her year in office, Espinosa's resume has been nothing short of jaw-dropping. She served as Ecuador's Minister of National Defense and as Coordinating Minister of Natural and Cultural Heritage. She has also been Ecuador's Minister of Foreign Affairs twice. It wasn't a burning need to work in politics that's driven her career path, however. It all started when she pursued two of her passions, language and geography. And about the former, did we mention Espinosa is also a published poet? I read poetry every day, no matter how late I go to bed or how busy I am, says Espinosa, who earned her first degree in linguistics. It's like when you say you have to brush your teeth or you have to drink water. I read poetry as part of my existential need. She counts Maya Angelou and Garcia Lorca among those who've written her favorite poems, and while she has precious little time to write these days, Espinosa calls the art form the bread and butter of my existence. And the truth is, in diplomacy, the weight and the power of words, of narratives, is so important, she continues. That's where poetry helps. After college, Espinosa's other passion led her to the Amazon. I have a master's degree in Amazonian studies, she explains. The Amazon itself is shared by 8 countries, so when looking at the Amazon, you immediately have to look beyond the national borders. Espinosa's early jobs in academia introduced her to the political arena, as she worked to help protect all forms of life in the region. At the time in the 90s, the Amazon was a big thing, and biodiversity conservation and indigenous peoples' rights were an international issue. Becoming Minister of National Defense years later tapped Espinosa's knack for sussing out how complex interconnected systems operate so that she could work within them to effect major change. To know that you are in charge of the armed forces of your country, the defense policy, the security issues of the country, and the protection of your national borders, it's a big challenge, she says, adding that her new predominantly male colleagues weren't used to having a woman as minister. Further, critical public opinion was saying, a female, a geographer, a poet, She adds it's about understanding the culture very quickly and also learning to work together with the military. They're professional, well-organized, very efficient in the way they deliver, and they need strong leadership. I was able to do that. Espinoza cites a ministerial directive to prevent and combat violence and harassment against women in the armed forces, as well as the military's first gender equality policy, as some of the most satisfying projects she helped bring about. In her time as president of the UN General Assembly, Espinoza says two things surprised her. First, when it came to equality at the United Nations, there was still work to be done there, too. You have to twist arms here to make sure that all our panels have gender parity, that the negotiations are equally co-chaired with female ambassadors and male ambassadors. The second need she hadn't anticipated? Eradicating the in-house plastic bottle problem. I said, no, 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 this cannot be. And I put all of my energy with the support of the UN Secretary General, Espinoza explains. Finally, after several months of work, we are a single-use plastic-free venue. The UN also launched a global campaign against plastic pollution and passed important legislation intended to curb toxic trash dumping. In both August and in September, her last month as president, Espinoza welcomed another ardent environmentalist to the United Nations, Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old Swedish activist whose speech at the 2019 United Nations Climate Action Summit has gone viral. It's hard not to think of Thunberg as Espinoza shares advice for young women who'd like to be president of the UN General Assembly themselves one day. You have to have a passion for fixing the world. Be a dreamer. Be audacious. Our next article by Madeline Frank Reeves is titled 9 Ways to Forgive, Forget, and Move On. In the aftermath of being wronged, no matter how large or small the offense, forgiveness can seem like an elusive, almost mythical concept. Whether facing a betrayal by a friend, infidelity in a marriage, or any kind of hurt you're hanging on to from the past, it can feel unfair that on top of dealing with the unpleasant effects of the event, you have to do the work to find forgiveness and move past it. Ultimately, though, forgiving others' wrongdoings can have a huge impact on your own well-being. Dr. Taylor Vanderweel, a forgiveness researcher and co-director of the Initiative on Health, Religion, and Spirituality at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, explains that our research indicates that forgiving an offender over time leads to lower levels of depression and anxiety and higher levels of hope, happiness, life satisfaction, and self-esteem. Sounds great, right? But perhaps no. Definitely easier said than done. Luckily, throughout years of research, Dr. Vanderweel and others have found specific proven steps and methods anyone can use to help them forgive and forget. Dr. Frederick Luskin, director of the Stanford Forgiveness Project and author of Forgive for Good, A Proven Prescription for Health and Happiness, and Forgive for Love, The Missing Ingredient for a Healthy and Happy Relationship, eagerly points to 3 main takeaways from his decades of studies. First, that forgiveness is a teachable skill no matter how large the offense. Second, that becoming more forgiving is good for your physical and emotional health. And third, that it's not an immediate response. There's a process to find a resolution to your grief, he explains. Here, these 2 experts in the field explain some of the methods that have helped people reach forgiveness for everything from cheating to the death of a child. Understand that forgiving someone isn't a sign of weakness. Sometimes there's a misconception that forgiving is about giving in or that it's letting people trample all over you, says Dr. Vanderweel. The research we've done suggests that's not the case, and that it's actually an incredibly powerful and self-healing response to an offense. He explains that his researchers define forgiveness, at the most basic level, as the replacing of ill will toward the person with goodwill, so that the victim is no longer held captive to the offender or to the feelings of bitterness and anger. The result, his research indicates, is that forgiving someone who hurt you leads to lower levels of depression and anxiety and higher levels of hope, happiness, life satisfaction, and self-esteem. Try reframing forgiveness as wanting to find those things for yourself, because you can forgive without condoning unacceptable behavior. forgiveness and reconciliation are not necessarily the same thing. When someone hurts you, especially in cases of cheating and infidelity, it's important to draw a distinction between forgiveness, again, wishing goodwill toward the offender, and reconciliation. Forgiveness, Dr. Vanderwill explains, can sometimes bring about reconciliation, but not always. And there are situations where reconciliation may not even be appropriate. Dr. Vanderwill points to cases of domestic violence and consistently unchanged behavior as examples. And in cases of infidelity, reconciliation takes work from both people. Infidelity is really painful and destructive within a relationship. And when there's been a betrayal of trust, one person's forgiveness alone isn't sufficient to reconcile and move forward, says Dr. Vanderwiel. There needs to be, in addition, repentance on the part of the offender and some sort of assurance that this isn't going to happen again. Both partners have to want that healing to take place. When you're ready to forgive, first start by calming the nervous system. Dr. Luskin has a 4-step process to help people work towards forgiveness, and it starts by practicing stress management when upset. He explains that when people are hurt or offended, their adrenaline spikes, and adrenaline's purpose is to make you focus on a problem and not let it go. The body develops that habitual adrenal response so that every time the issue comes to mind, the adrenaline spikes again. To change the body's response, he instructs people to take 2 deep belly breaths and then think about something positive every time the offense comes to mind. After 50 or so times of practicing this, the body can more effectively calm itself. Evoke your capacity for gratitude. The next step in Dr. Luskin's process involves becoming more thankful, because when you see things that are wrong, you need to also notice what's right in order to create a nervous system balance and the ability to tell a different story. He has patients take time to appreciate things like pleasant weather or beautiful sunsets or other small things in their lives that they're grateful for, further calming the nervous system. Remember, you don't always get what you want. These seemingly harsh words are critical to Dr. Luskin's method, as forgiveness is about situations that didn't work out the way we want, he says. This cognitive framing helps you work towards acceptance and even lowers blood pressure. Change how you tell the story in your head. Once you've taken those steps to get into a different headspace, it helps you change the story in your mind from one in which you're the victim of a terrible deed to one in which you're a hero for forgiving said deed. Ultimately, forgiveness is a change in story, said Dr. Luskin. Instead of the poor me narrative, it's look how I've grown, learned, and handled the situation. Look how I've overcome adversity. He explains how that mindset can, for example, help someone leaving an unhealthy relationship to go on to have another, healthier relationship in the future. Suddenly, you're able to say, even if that person treated me horribly and the relationship was a complete disaster, I'm not giving up on relationships because I know I can get through anything. Alternatively, try the REACH method to forgive the past. Dr. Vanderwiel encourages people to practice forgiveness working through the process of this acronym for recall, emphasize, altruistic gift, commit, and hold. This model has been used in a number of randomized trials and one-on-one group therapy, and has been shown to lower depression and anxiety and increase hope and forgiveness. Dr. Vanderwiel's team of researchers are currently further exploring the impact of this intervention model globally in the form of a 2-hour workbook. Step by step, the REACH process looks like this. Recall. Think about the wrongdoing objectively without suppressing it. Empathize. Try to put yourself in the shoes of the other person and consider whether there were motivations at play besides hatred. You don't need to minimize the wrongdoing or invalidate your own emotions, but try to think about ways in which the action may not have been personal. Altruistic gift. Think of giving forgiveness as a gift. Most people feel better about themselves when they give to others, and forgiveness works that way as well. It can also be helpful to reflect on a time that someone else gave you the gift of forgiveness and to think about how that felt. Commit. Commit to forgiving. You can do this by telling the offender face to face, telling someone else, or even writing it down. Hold. Hold on to the forgiveness that has happened, realizing that the emotional side of it may still take time. Remember that forgetting shouldn't be your goal. You've probably heard people talk about forgive and forget as a concept, but the consensus among psychologists and researchers is that that's a very misguided and untrue sentiment, says Dr. Luskin. Sure, there are small things you can forget, like if someone tells a tiny lie to get out of dinner plans, but anything that's real and important, you can't forget, nor should you. The key to finding forgiveness isn't suppressing memories or never thinking of them again, but rather remembering differently and doing the work to go from remembering it as a victim to remembering as a form of coping with a more resilient take and without the emotional charge. Practice forgiveness every day. You can actually train yourself to have forgiveness as a personality trait. When you make it a practice to forgive others for small offenses, like cutting you off on the highway or any small offense within the context of marriage, it actually shapes your character and makes you more likely to feel goodwill towards others, says Dr. Vanderweel, adding, that can lead to a better life and a better society as well, helping break the cycle of offense and retaliation. Our next article by Samantha Vicente is titled, Jay Cook and Tanya Van Culenborg's Killer Was Found Through His Family Tree. It took 30 years for the families of Tanya Van Culenborg and Jay Cook to see someone arrested and convicted for the young Canadian couple's murders on U.S. soil. And like the law enforcement teams who've been pursuing the case since 1987, they never expected to see the Washington State cold case solved by way of an investigative technique only recently applied to criminal investigations, genetic genealogy, which uses forensic DNA to locate relatives of a possible suspect. Pioneer genetic genealogist C.C. Moore recounts her role in what would be the first criminal case involving the method to ever go before a jury. Here's the full story of what happened to Tanya Van Culenborg and Jay Cook on what was supposed to be a simple fun trip to Seattle, and why William Talbot II was sentenced for the double murder decades later. Jay Cook and Tanya Van Culenborg were last seen on November 18, 1987. Jay Cook and Tanya Van Culenborg both lived in Saanich, a district in the Greater Victoria area of British Columbia, Canada. According to local Washington paper, The Herald, Cook's family remembers him as a gangly, sweet 20-year-old who played bass guitar. Jay had no rough edges, his uncle is quoted as saying. Tanya was very sweet and caring, and they looked up to each other, Cook's sister, Laura Bonstra, told The Herald. Van Culenborg played tennis and basketball and adored her golden retriever, Tessa. She had dreams of working with animals one day. As Tanya's brother, John Van Culenborg, says on The Genetic Detective, Tanya Van Culenborg had graduated high school in June of 1987. She and Cook had been dating for 6 months when he asked her to accompany him on an overnight trip to South Seattle to pick up furnace parts for his father. The couple left town in a bronze Ford Club wagon van per Washington CBS affiliate KREM, arriving at Port Angeles, Washington at 4 p.m. off the vehicle ferry from Victoria. But Cook never showed up to collect the parts. The Herald reports the two were encountered in the Washington town of Hoodsport, where a store clerk testified that she gave the seemingly lost pair directions off of Highway 101. Van Culenborg and Cook were last seen alive in the town of Allen, closer to Seattle, where a deli clerk said they didn't have anyone else with them. Another ticket, purchased at 10:16 p.m. for the ferry from Bremerton to Seattle, was later found in the recovered van they drove, leading police to believe that just before midnight they did make it to Seattle, where they were likely abducted. They were first reported missing on November 19, 1987, when they never returned home. On November 24, 1987, Tanya Van Culenborg's partially nude body was found by a passerby in a wooded area near a rural road close to Mount Vernon, Washington. Her hands were bound with zip ties, She had been shot in the back of the head, and there was evidence of sexual assault. Van Culenborg's wallet, keys, a pair of surgical gloves, and a half-empty box of .380 handgun ammunition were found under the porch of a tavern in Bellingham, Washington, the following day. According to KOMO Seattle, the Ford Club wagon van was discovered a block away from the tavern by the local Greyhound station. Inside the locked van were more rubber gloves and plastic ties, essentially confirming whoever it was who'd killed Van Culenborg had planned for the opportunity. On November 26th, Thanksgiving Day, a hunter came across Jay Cook's body under a blue blanket near a bridge roughly 50 miles away from where Tanya's body was found. He'd been beaten, strangled with dog collars and twine, and tissue and a pack of Camel cigarettes had been shoved down his throat. Because the location of the abandoned van was closer to where Van Culenborg's body was found, police concluded that Cook was presumably killed first. It was obvious that this was all one crime, and it appeared that the intent of the killer was focusing on raping Tanya. Detective Jim Scharf, part of the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office cold case team, says on the genetic detective. Though medical examiners found semen from the attacker on Tanya and her clothing, genetic testing wasn't yet widely available as a forensic resource in 1987. With no witnesses and no description of the killer to go on, the trail of what happened to the two Canadians went cold. Fortunately, Washington State Patrol stored the evidence, and they were able to create a DNA profile from the sample by 1994. William Earl Talbot II was convicted for their murders in 2018. Using the DNA collected at the crime scenes, Parabon Nanotech, a Virginia-based DNA technology company, was able to create something called a phenotype report in April of 2018. The DNA phenotyping report produced computer-generated images of the suspect's age progression since the year of the crime. While the images sparked many tips, KOMO reports, none led to a specific suspect. After genetic genealogy helped connect the dots to a possible person of interest, Snohomish County authorities began to trail Talbot and obtained a DNA sample from a discarded paper cup in May of 2018. It was a full match to the DNA from Van Culenborg's crime scene. Skagit County authorities arrested a truck driver named William Earl Talbot II that same month. Talbot was 24 at the time of the murders, and his parents lived roughly 7 miles from where Cook's body was found. Arguing that he was innocent throughout the trial, Talbot and attorneys said he did have sex with Tanya Van Culenborg, but claimed it was consensual and that someone else must have killed her later. After a criminal trial that included the DNA evidence and testimony from Talbot's former roommates and police interviews with his family that recounted past incidents of violence, Talbot was sentenced to life without parole in July 2019. It's bitter and sweet. There's a lot of good memories, of course, 20 years of them, Leona Cook, Jay Cook's mother, says about finally getting closure regarding her son's death. It was just a thrilling, thrilling day when they said, "We've got him." Cece Moore helped track Abbott down using genetic genealogy. Detective Scharf contacted Parabon Nanotech on April 20, 2018 with a request. Scharf hoped their new employee, Cece Moore, could use her skills to track him down through her mix of genealogy research, internet detective skills, and the DNA on file. "I am part of the very small group of people that created genetic genealogy," Moore says. She adds that she initially struggled with the ethics of agreeing to apply her techniques to criminal investigations, a concern shared by privacy watchdogs and at least one since-cleared man who was investigated due to a partial match of his DNA. In fact, the public genealogy database that Moore and her colleagues initially relied on for their crime scene DNA comparison research, GEDmatch, changed their privacy policy in May of 2019. Now users have to opt in to make their information available to law enforcement. But a landmark win for genetic genealogy convinced Moore that it was the right thing to do. In April 2018, it led to the arrest of a suspect believed to be the Golden State Killer, the man behind at least 12 murders, 50 rapes, and over 100 burglaries, whose horrifically violent and unsolved spree was chronicled in Michelle McNamara's book All Begone in the Dark. Whittling down genetic profile comparisons led investigators to Joseph James D'Angelo of Citrus Heights, California, and DNA samples from a tissue in his trash proved a match to semen recovered at the crime scenes. Though Moore wasn't involved in catching D'Angelo, she saw his capture as confirmation that this method could bring more closure to victims' families. She teamed up with Parabon Nano Labs that same month and was brought onto her first criminal case in 2018, the murders of Cook and Van Culemborg. Moore created and currently heads up genetic genealogy services for Parabon's law enforcement unit. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled Why Daniel Brooks Felt Destined to Play Mahalia Jackson, the Queen of Gospel. Danielle Brooks says she manifested the role of Mahalia Jackson. It's so powerful, that manifestation thing. I'm grateful it worked out, Brooks, best known for her role as Natasha Tasty Jefferson on Orange is the New Black, tells Oprah Daily. Brooks is the star of Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia, a biopic about the Queen of Gospel that premiered April 3rd on Lifetime. Speaking to Oprah Daily, Brooks reveals she's been envisioning herself in the role ever since her Tony Award-winning turn in The Color Purple in 2015. While backstage, Brooks co-star Jennifer Hudson remarked that Brooks sounded like Jackson when she sang, quite the compliment. Once, when reflecting on Jackson's gorgeous sound, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said a voice like hers comes along once in a millennium. Jennifer said, "You should play her." She didn't think anything of it. I don't even know if she remembers it. But that's something that stuck with me forever, until now, Brooks recalls. When Jennifer Holliday joined the Color Purple cast and made the same comment, Brooks felt fated to play Jackson. "If there's anyone in this world that I should play, it should be her," Brooks says. The only problem? There was no Mahalia Jackson project in the works at the time. While appearing in Much Ado About Nothing in New York, she expressed her dreams to director Kenny Leon. "I said, I want to play Mahalia Jackson." And he said, "Well, hell, I want to direct Mahalia Jackson," Brooks says. A year later, Leon approached Brooks for the part. The landscape has since changed. Jill Scott will play the trailblazing singer in another Mahalia Jackson biop called Mahalia, produced by Queen Latifah and Jamie Foxx. Unlike other gospel singers of the 20th century, such as Aretha Franklin, Jackson refused to make the leap to pop music. With a career spanning from 1920 to 1972, Jackson achieved mainstream success at a time when gospel wasn't mainstream. Her breakthrough hit, Move On Up a Little Higher, released in 1947, was one of the highest-selling gospel singles in history. In 1950, Jackson became the first gospel singer to perform at Carnegie Hall, and she sang there annually for years afterward. She toured around the world and performed for presidents, kings, and queens. Her tremendous popularity led to the emergence of a black gospel sound in American pop. She also was a trailblazer in the civil rights movement as well. As legend has it, it's thanks to her that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech exists at all. After performing at the March on Washington, she shouted for King to tell them about the dream. According to witnesses, King put his prepared speech aside and did just that. Below, Brooks tells us what she learned while finally playing the Queen of Gospel, an uncompromising woman who achieved success on her own terms. "Your voice sounds like Mahalia's. Did you relate to her in any other way?" "Oh yeah, there were a lot of ways that I related to her. Mahalia had imposter syndrome when it came to singing at Carnegie Hall. She didn't want to do it because she was afraid that she wasn't skilled or trained enough. I could definitely relate to that. I went through that when I was in The Color Purple and got my first Tony nomination for my first time on Broadway. I was intimidated by the gift that God had given me." That's what she went through sometimes too. It's so great that she overcame that fear. She opened so many doors for so many black women. To have been on the Ed Sullivan Show, to have toured Europe, to have broken records selling her music, that's a huge deal. I also relate to her spirituality. I grew up in the church. My parents are very involved in the church, and so was I. I totally understand her mindset of wanting to please God and serve God. I understand where she's coming from. There's a moment where Mahalia cures someone with her voice. It's quite moving. I think of that scene as a metaphor. Her voice really did heal people. It healed so many people that were being abused, hurt, and felt dehumanized by America at the time. She was the mouthpiece. I think her music healed black people as well as other races to come to grips with their behavior and realize that's not how God would want them to operate. She served such a huge purpose within that time and had so much influence. When it comes to if I've ever seen my own miracle happen, I think I have. I think it's a miracle just to get to where I've gotten. There are so many full circle moments in my life, like when I was on The Color Purple. It was the first Broadway show that I'd seen as a teenager at 15. Then to step into it on Broadway, win a Grammy and a Tony, and be interviewed by Oprah, I made my parents so proud. I'm a little girl from South Carolina that grew up in a rural area and didn't have any examples of success when it came to acting. I would see my own story as miraculous. I made it. Speaking of, it's an amazing year for you and your Color Purple co-stars. You're playing Mahalia, and Symphony Arrivo and Jennifer Hudson are both playing Aretha Franklin. I talk to them both and we celebrate each other. I know how much influence Mahalia had on Aretha Franklin. It is so wild that all of us are doing biopics at the same time. What are the odds of that happening? I'm excited for them both to shine and for all of us to have our moment and show that we're capable of doing and use all of our talents. I'm really happy. This year we have new movies about Ma Rainey, Billie Holiday, Mahalia Jackson, and Aretha Franklin. I think sometimes the black women get lost in what we've left America, the value that we've added to this country. These movies are a great reminder of what we've been able to accomplish, and to also inspire the next generation of women coming after us of how much we're capable of doing. I've enjoyed that our movie highlights women behind the scenes as well, like Jackson's pianist Mildred Falls, who would never get their individual stories told. There are so many women who have influenced music, like Ella Fitzgerald, Ethel Waters, Sarah Vaughan, who have yet to have their lights lit again. I think these movies are a reminder. Let's not forget. We're talking about the queen of gospel music, and there are so many other queens out there, and there will be so many after. Let's take a moment to celebrate black women. The New York Times asked readers to identify Mahalia Jackson in a picture, and very few could. What do you see Mahalia's legacy as today? It's great to hear you say that. It's true, a lot of people don't know much about her, but she made such a huge impact on the civil rights movement. The fact that we have the I Have a Dream speech is because of her. She yelled out to Martin, "Tell him about the dream," which solidifies to me how close they must have been. For someone to feel comfortable in that platform during the March on Washington with hundreds of thousands of people watching, to lead him to a conversation they must have had. That tells me how close she was to these leaders. She was singing for presidents and supporting JFK. She was lending her voice to sway people to vote for what she felt was the right side of history. I want to make sure we keep her voice alive. How does it feel to you when you're listening to one of her songs? I hear it in my heart chakra. She touches my heart. Kenny Leon, our director, said that he would listen to her for about an hour every day for several weeks straight. I was listening to her as I was on the seawall in Vancouver having a bad day once. I turned her on to see if my spirit would be lifted, and it was. It's the power of music. I heard someone say once that that's the second most powerful thing in the world after prayer. I really believe it's true. Our next article by Melissa Goldberg is titled 18 True Romantic Stories That Are More Heartwarming Than Any Rom-Com. Of course, The Notebook, Titanic, and When Harry Met Sally all have a special place in our heart and film cues. But you know what we adore even more than these classic rom-coms? Tales of love that are actually real. Bob Harvey and Annette Adkins. Bob Harvey first met Annette Adkins during study hall in 1955 and was immediately smitten. "I couldn't take my eyes off her," Harvey told the New York Times. "She had auburn hair and a stunningly beautiful face, and her eyes were just wow." The two teens ended up going to prom together, but as many young relationships go, they lost touch after high school and married other people. Harvey never forgot about Atkins, though. In 2017, after his wife died, he searched for Atkins on Google and discovered she had also become widowed. He sent her a card with his phone number, and after chatting for a bit, Harvey drove 500 miles to visit her, stopping only for gas and a bouquet of carnations. I handed her the flowers, and then I cupped her face in my hand and said, "Whether you like it or not, I'm going to kiss you," he recalled. In October, the high school sweethearts married at a 50s-style diner and danced to Johnny Mathis, just like they did at prom 63 years earlier. Matthew Pomeroy and Natasha Lamb. Talk about an encore. On December 27th, Matthew Pomeroy, who plays the title character in a British production of Aladdin, proposed to his girlfriend Natasha Lamb, who plays Jasmine, just after taking their final vows. "For the last 4 years, you have changed my life," he told Lamb, before pulling out a shining, shimmering, splendid ring. "I love you with all my heart. You're my best friend, and if you let me, I want to be your husband." Elan Gale and Molly C. Quinn. What do you get when you cross an American actress with a former producer of ABC's The Bachelor? A made-for-TV marriage proposal. During a weekend getaway to Seattle, Elan Gale and his then-girlfriend of 8 months, Molly C. Quinn, stopped by a jewelry store where she fell in love with a vintage emerald ring. "If you ever do propose to me, try to find something to kind of look like this," said Quinn. The next day, Gale returned to the store, bought the ring, and placed it in a box under their bed for the next 3 years. "That's where the ring has been hiding for the last 40 months, he recalled in an Instagram post, 3 feet away from where Molly sleeps every night. In December 2019, while on a ski trip in Japan, Gale finally popped the question. Liz and Scott Shoesmith. Most wedding planning checklists include picking a dress, finding a venue, and booking a photographer. Liz Shoesmith also included learning how to sign the lyrics to one of her favorite songs. Instead of the traditional walk down the aisle, the Australian bride surprised her husband, who is deaf, by signing the words to Christine Perry's hit song, "A Thousand Years," as she walked towards him. "Every time I had practiced it leading up to the day, I would make mistakes or go blank," she told Inside Edition. "But when I was left at the top of the aisle and locked eyes with Scott, I didn't look away. It honestly felt like we were the only ones in the room." Jessica Scher and Aaron Long. More than a decade after using an anonymous sperm donor to start a family, Jessica Scher met her daughter's biological father and fell in love with him. In 2016, Scher's daughter, Alice Mickle, asked her grandmother for a 23andMe kit to look into her genealogy. When the results came back 8 weeks later, Aaron Long was listed as a 50% parental match. Mikkel and Scher connected with Long, and eventually the two parents decided to meet. "When we met in person, the attraction seemed harder for either of us to deny," Long told Good Morning America. Scher, though, had reservations. "This was not my relationship or my journey to jump into and mess up forever," she said in the same interview. Now, 2.5 years later, Scher, Long, and Mikkel live together in Seattle, along with Long's 22-year-old daughter, Maddie, who he also had through sperm donation. "A few people have called us some sort of new Brady Bunch," Scher told People. "I think Mikkel thinks it's kind of funny that everybody thinks it's a big deal." Sunette Thompson and Lisa Wyatt. In July 2018, Sunette Thompson and her then-fiancé Lisa Wyatt traveled to New Orleans for a few fun-filled days at Essence Festival. But unbeknownst to Wyatt, there was a much bigger event on that weekend's agenda, their wedding. On the morning of July 8, 2018, which was also the couple's 10th anniversary, Wyatt served Thompson breakfast in bed and told her to change into the tux hanging in the closet. Once Wyatt was dressed, she was blindfolded and taken down to the hotel's courtyard, where more than 100 of the couple's friends and families had gathered. "Needless to say, I was completely overwhelmed," Wyatt told Essence magazine. "As I surveyed the audience, I cried profusely, the ugly cry." KT Robbins and Janine Pearson. If there's a story that proves true love stands the test of time, it's this one. In 1944, 24-year-old K.T. Robbins met 18-year-old Janine Ganay while he was stationed in Briley, France, and over the next 3 months, the two fell in love. But their courtship came to a crashing halt when Robbins was transferred to fight on the Eastern Front during World War II. After the war, Robbins went home to Memphis and got married to another woman. Back in France, Gayenne, now Pearson, also moved on with her life. Fast forward to 2019, when Robbins returned to France for the 75th anniversary of D-Day and was interviewed by journalists from the television station France 2 about his World War II experience. The reporters helped Robbins track down Pearson, and the two long-lost lovers, both 92, reunited in the French nursing home where Pearson lives. "I always loved you," Robbins told her as they embraced. "You never got out of my heart." After spending a couple of hours together, the two had to say goodbye, but they vowed to meet again soon. Gillian Hanson and Max Allegretti. 2.5 years ago, Gillian Hanson was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer. Knowing she would face a tough battle ahead, she offered her boyfriend, Max Allegretti, an out before things got too intense. But Allegretti didn't flinch and instead stayed by her side doing 2 years of aggressive treatment. "They tell you how sick you get during treatment, but no one can really prepare you for any of this," Hanson wrote in a personal essay. "He took care of me every day and reminded me how beautiful I was." On her last day of chemo, Allegretti knew exactly how he wanted to celebrate, by asking Hanson to marry him. "I wasn't expecting it," she told Good Morning America. "That was the ultimate high. Getting engaged brought great light to me after a really dark spot." Lee Lockler and Stuthi David. After a magical proposal, Lee Lockler and Stuthi David are destined to live happily ever after. When Lockler took David to a packed theater to see her favorite movie, Sleeping Beauty, she thought it was just a typical date night, but it was actually a cinematic event 6 months in the making. Lockler, a filmmaker, had spent half a year altering the animation of the film's iconic kissing scene, changing both the characters, so they more closely represented the real-life couple, and the storyline, so it set up the big question. She said yes, and now the fairy tale continues. Comrie and Steve Curto. When Comrie Curto gave birth to her son Gavin, she suffered a stroke and a seizure, which caused her to be placed in a medically induced coma. When she awoke, both her long-term and short-term memory were gone, and she did not know who she or her family was. A few months later, she still didn't remember her husband Steve. "We were sitting on the couch, and she told me, 'I don't know who you are, but I know I love you,'" he recalled to People. Those words inspired Steve to write a book called But I Know I Love You, that would help Camry remember their 10-year love story, recounting everything from their very first date to their wedding to the birth of their son. It's working, and today Camry knows and remembers Gavin and Steve. Terry Farley and Steve Downey. More than 3 decades after they first dated, two high school sweethearts reconnected, thanks to LinkedIn. In the fall of 2012, Terry Farley, who had gotten divorced a couple years earlier, happened upon the profile of her first boyfriend, Steve Downey. She clicked on it, but was hesitant to message him. She told NPR, "I was not going to be the old girlfriend that popped out of nowhere and said, 'Remember me?'" But a month later, when Downey was looking at his LinkedIn page, he noticed Farley's name in the section that tells you who has been looking at your profile. Downey wrote her a quick message, which turned into phone calls, which turned into an invitation to visit Farley at her home in Tallahassee, Florida. "I didn't see anything except my first love, my first crush," she told Today. "It felt like we were picking up where we left off." Eventually, Downey moved to Tallahassee, and in 2015, they tied the knot. Tori Monaco and Berkeley Cade. What are the chances of two people planning a proposal on the same day, at the same time, and without the other knowing? Probably pretty small, but that's precisely what happened for Tori Monaco and Berkeley Cade. In February 2018, the pair was playing a game of Pictionary at Cade's parents' house in Seattle, and as Cade tried to draw the phrase, "Will you marry me?" on the board, Monaco got down on one knee and asked her that exact question. Stunned, Cade reached behind the couch and pulled out a ring box herself. The mastermind behind the simultaneous proposal? Cade's mom, Christy, who separately suggested to both women that they propose during a game of Pictionary when they visited Washington. Barbara and Robert Shackelford. This Christmas was Barbara Shackelford's first one without her high school sweetheart, Robert, who passed away in May after 59 years of marriage. But she still felt his warmth, thanks to a special surprise from her family. The love letter she and Robert exchanged in 1962 while in college. She had no idea he kept the letters, and it really brought back a lot of memories of her early years loving him, Shackelford's granddaughter told Today. She said it was the best gift she could have asked for. Ann and Bill Duncan. Ann and Bill Duncan are in the honeymoon phase of their relationship, but unlike most couples going through this new and exciting stage, the Duncans are married and have been for 12 years. After living with dementia for nearly a decade, Bill started having trouble recognizing and remembering Ann. When he asked her to marry him again, Ann said yes. 2 days later, the happy couple celebrated their second wedding surrounded by friends and family. It was wonderful, Ann posted on Facebook. And what's even more amazing is 2 weeks later, Bill still thinks he's just married his new girlfriend, and it makes him very happy. Dominic Spence and Nick Gilliard. Need proof that true love is worth the wait? Dominic Spence and Nick Gilliard met while they were teenagers in high school, but lost touch when they headed in different directions for college. Spence attended the University of Central Florida in Orlando, while Gilliard went to college in Kentucky. They reconnected, though, when Gilliard helped a friend move into her dorm in Orlando and asked Dominic to dinner. That night we talked for 4 hours and shut down the restaurant, Gilliard said in an Instagram post. They started dating long distance for the next 7 years. In 2015, Spence and Gilliard got engaged during a trip to London, and nearly 2 years later they were married. Dominic and I feel lucky to have found love at such a young age. However, falling in love with another black man was scary in ways neither of us could have ever imagined. It forced us to face the very real resistance from society for being not only homosexuals, but black men as well, Gilliard said in the same Instagram post. We hope to encourage other black and brown men and boys everywhere to be true to who they are, and when they find love in each other's eyes, to know that their love is just as strong and beautiful as anyone else's. Brad Davis and Jody Stanowick. As a young girl, Anna Stanowick's mom, Jody, would often bring home a new coffee mug to add to her collection, despite her then-husband's angry protests. When the couple divorced 5 years ago, Jody and her massive collection were ready to find a new man. Enter Brad Davis, who pulled off the ultimate public display of affection when he built Jody a custom, ceiling-high shelf for her beloved coffee cups just before moving in together. I wanted to do this for Jody so that she could enjoy all of the mugs every day instead of just drinking out of one each day, Davis told Today. We'll raise a mug to that. Sid Sinha and Melanie Diaz. Wedding proposal in aisle three. Last year, Sid Sinha proposed to his girlfriend Melanie Diaz at the Trader Joe's in New York City's Upper West Side. Sinha concocted the elaborate plan, which included a made-up millennial grocery tour featuring special signs that were symbolic of their relationship. She's made it perfectly clear that Trader Joe's is her favorite grocery store, so I knew if I went that route, I had to do it there, Sinha told Good Morning America. The final stop on the tour? The sample station, where an employee was passing out chocolate-covered almonds. Inside Diaz's cup, though, was an engagement ring. A dream come true indeed. Judy and Will Webb. Judy and Will Webb were together until the very end, really. The couple, who spent almost every day together during their 56 years of marriage, died just hours apart on March 6th while, wait for it, holding hands. Our next article by Taylor Harris is titled, Cycling Gave Me a Space Centered on My Experiences as a Black Person to Process Pain. I started taking spin classes in 2018 at a local gym because I felt sexy riding in the dark, my quads firing, my feet finding the song's beats. I kept spinning because the studio's darkness became a sanctuary, a place I could bring my burdens. When I awaited my then 7-year-old son's test results after a seizure, and when my friend prepared for her heart transplant, I dragged myself onto the bike. pushing against the weight of the flywheel, silently praying beneath the noise, lightened the emotional load I carried in my chest. But in mid-March 2020, days after my son and I flew home from his appointment at the Cleveland Clinic, the world shut down, taking my gym with it. It took about 4 minutes of unsuccessful kettlebell wielding in my basement to inspire me to shell out $2,000 for a Peloton, the trendy exercise bike that promises a cutting-edge virtual cycling experience through live and on-demand classes. To say I quickly became a fan of instructor Tunde Onyen, Peloton's red-lipsticked, chiseled-armed queen, would be an understatement. Riding out of the saddle, hitting my cadence, and breathlessly singing along to a spicy remix of Tamia's 2001 R&B hit Stranger in My House, I was Tunde. Until I caught a reflection of my basic moves and pale, saggy arms in the HD screen and realized I was the mom jeans version of her. Under normal circumstances, Tunde's confidence and eclectic taste in music would have been enough to get me on my bike several nights a week. But as spring turned to summer and personal suffering melded with collective pain, I needed more than your average endorphin boost to keep going. In early May, my husband was notified that his university's provost had upheld the decision by an all-white committee to deny him tenure. Fortunately, we rallied supporters online and got the decision overturned a few months later. Meanwhile, my son started voicing his fears, asking more questions about his seizures. Mommy, what if I have to ride in an ambulance to the hospital now and that it's the coronavirus? Sorrow and worry at home folded into grief and rage from the outside world as I watched Ahmaud Arbery killed by white men in broad daylight. I wondered how many times his mother had taken him to the doctor as a child, had kept him alive only to lose him to racists. I grew weak under the weight of George Floyd's final call for his mother as he fought for breath under the knee of a cop, killed over a $20 bill. I read of a young Breonna Taylor sentenced to death by firing squad for sleeping. On the night of June 4th, I clipped my spin shoes into my bike pedals and selected a recording of Tunde's first Speak Up ride, the start of a series of classes that address racism and empathy. Dressed in black, surrounded by empty bikes, she rode alone in Peloton's New York studio, but together with those of us who understood that George Floyd's murder was a sharp echo of a sound we'd heard before. A few minutes in, she closed her eyes, took a deep breath, and emerged as if from prayer. Black lives matter. They've always mattered. The question is, she said, stretching her arms out at her sides, why did it take this long to figure that out? I pulled back the resistance and allowed my legs to slow. Grabbing a towel, I covered my face and wept, unable to fight the thought of losing my son to racism after having spent so many nights hoping his own body wouldn't betray him. Panting, her legs pedaling rapidly, Tunde quoted a colleague and philosophized, "We don't just hurt in times like this. We don't pause our hurt and our pain until the next George Floyd situation. Black people," she said, spacing her hands out in front of her, "we hurt in the in-between." With the pandemic, the racism, and the longing to reassure my son that he'd be safe whether lying in bed or walking on the sidewalk, I'd been hurting in the in-between. What I needed in 2020, what I've always needed, was a space centered on my experiences as a black person in this country. A space where I could process layers of pain before anyone dared command me to hope. Tunde skipped the typical 1 minute cool down, urging us not to leave our emotions and convictions on the bike, but to use them as a force for change in the world. As Peace Train by Cat Stevens began, she tilted her head back, lips parted. Then she repeated the lyrics, "Someday it's going to come. Come on, Peace Train." For the first time in 30 minutes, I saw her smile, and it felt like an invitation, not a betrayal of my pain, to join her. We're going to end today with a story by Alina Nicolou titled Best Travel Books That Will Take You All Around the World. The easiest way to travel without a plane ticket? Open up a book and skip the jet lag. The best travel books offer more than a checklist of tourist attractions. Rather, they intertwine sightseeing with self-discovery. These timeless travel books are as relevant in 2021 as they were when they were written, and they all have one thing in common. They'll take you on a journey and perhaps even change the way you see the world. 13 Little Blue Envelopes by Maureen Johnson. In this young adult page-turner, Jenny receives an inheritance from her recently deceased aunt in the form of 13 envelopes, each naming a destination. What does Jenny's Aunt Peg want her to find? Combine the adventure of a scavenger hunt with the joy of travel, and you'll get this novel, which adults will enjoy too. Atlas Obscura, an explorer's guide to the world's hidden wonders. Every city has its list of must-sees, but what about the places that don't make any top 10 list and are all the more magnificent for it? Atlas Obscura is devoted to rounding up the world's hidden gems. This Way Back by Joanna Elfitharu. Memorist Joanna Elfitharu spent her life traveling between the mountain village in Cyprus, where her father was from, and Queens, New York, where she went to high school. This Way Back is about the challenge of creating a sense of identity when you're from a place that has an identity crisis of its own. In 1974, following a Turkish invasion, Cyprus was partitioned, with its Greek population confined to the island's southern portion and Turkish population to the north. World Travel, An Irreverent Guide by Anthony Bourdain and Laurie Woolever. For years, the late Anthony Bourdain was a tour guide to our world through shows like No Reservations and Parts Unknown. He espoused a kind of travel that was less about sightseeing and more about learning about and respecting the culture around you through food. This book compiles Bourdain's guidance for navigating his favorite cities, including Buenos Aires, New York, and Shanghai, as well as other destinations. Journeys of a Lifetime, 500 of the World's Greatest Trips. Journeys of a Lifetime is the kind of book that will delight readers at any stage, because there's a trip for everyone. Retirees looking for their next adventure might enjoy some of the lengthier trips. Train across Europe, anyone? West with the Night by Beryl Markham. West with the Night is a gripping tale set in a time when air travel itself was a death-defying act. Beryl Markham was the first person to fly solo over the Atlantic, leaving from England and surviving a crash landing in Nova Scotia in 1936. She was also an adventurer, a horse trainer, an adrenaline seeker, and as this memoir shows, an excellent writer. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spergotta, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.